Well, just do a little discussion in kind of buzz groups, and I got some questions I'd like to hand you. Perhaps you four on this side could just kind of turn your chairs around, and here's a set of questions I'd like to have you talk about, and perhaps have a little chairman of your group to write down your answers. And if you all do the same thing over here, I think there's some more folks coming. We may start a third group here in a few minutes. I've got enough copies for probably almost everybody to have one. Okay. Let's see. I think there's about 8 copies here. Give you all at least one more, and I'll keep one for any other groups that come in. But I'd like to just take these 6 questions and just give about 2 or 3 minutes for each question. Try to think over what they're asking and what your ideas are, and I think it'll promote a little bit more thinking. Oh yeah, please do, and somebody can keep them. I don't think I have enough for everybody, but let's see. Why don't you three form a little circle somewhere back there? We're going to have some discussion. Whatever.
No, it seems like it.
Perhaps just a few minutes to talk on this issue will kind of get your mind headed in this direction. R-I-D-L-E-Y. Put that light on there. If it's too bright for overhead, you can just flip it back off in a few minutes. You like it on?
Yes.
Okay. My name is Bob Ridley. I'm from Colorado Springs, not too unrecently from Texas, and being from Dallas originally, and then we worked with the Navigators for about 6 years in the Fort Worth area, and then up in Denton, Texas for 4 years prior to moving here 2 years ago. So I identify with you, many of you from Texas, and also welcome you to Colorado, the cool country. You enjoying this nice weather up here? Okay. Well, as you've had a little chance to just think about, answer a few of these questions on the abortion issue, you probably realize that it's not a real easily cut and dried topic. And that is very, very true. And the further you get into it, I think the more difficulty there may be in arriving at a clear-cut answer in some of these issues. But I think that as a result of our discussion talk today, hopefully you'll have a little bit better idea of where the Bible speaks, when it speaks, and knowing some areas where it doesn't speak, and hopefully a little idea of how it relates to day-by-day Christian living and discipleship. And I don't know if any of you got that last question or not, but I want us to be sure to touch on that as we talk this morning. So let's just take about 4 or 5 minutes here and just get some ideas from what you discovered from these questions. Does the Bible say anything about abortion? Must not.
My dad used the word exactly the word abortion.
It refers to life.
Okay, a lot said about life, isn't there?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, would you agree that does anybody have any verses that directly relate to abortion? Any verses you know?
I've forgotten where in Exodus it's about 21 or 22, where 2 men are fighting and the wife is injured so that she has a miscarriage. There's, at least I think that's what it says.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's a penalty for the man you pay, but if her injury does not cause a miscarriage.
Well, it's a miscarriage,
yeah.
Natural.
Is there a difference?
Would think there would be, wouldn't you? Because one is accidentally induced by just a fall or a blow, whereas the other, so-called today's therapeutic abortion, is very intentional, very planned, deliberate, with an almost 100% predictable outcome. But that is a relative verse, and interestingly, it led at least one theologian off track when he tried to interpret it and apply it to 20th century moral issues. We'll talk about him in a few minutes. Okay.
Well, we were going to, not directly about abortion, but if you take it to be life, and then you can murder life, well, then that's Exodus 20:13. You shouldn't do that.
Sixth commandment?
Yeah.
Okay, good point. What do you think the product of conception becomes a person, a living soul? Any ideas on that?
I think Psalm 51, at least it says to me that it begins at conception, because David said, and he was talking about his own condition, he said, in sin my mother conceived me. And I don't think he's talking about his mother's sin, but his own sin nature. And I don't think that a thing has a sin nature, but only a person can have a sin nature.
Okay.
Psalm 139 talks about, in thy book were written all of them, the days that were formed for me, when as yet there were none of them. So then he's saying that, you know, God considers him and has plans for his future before he's ever born. Psalm 139 is relatively short.
Yeah, 13, 14, along there somewhere.
We felt like in Luke 2:41, where John the Baptist is in the womb and Mary comes and the baby leaps, that then you can identify two personalities, both John the Baptist and Jesus, because you have the one leaping on account of the other one. So John, I think Elizabeth was, I may be wrong with this, 3 months pregnant, and Mary was 6 months, but then Jesus was 3 months past the point of conception. So they have to put just at least there, I would think, if not much sooner.
Put right in the middle of pregnancies in both cases,
yeah.
It's probably 3 and 6 months, something like that.
Luke 2:41 and 42.
Okay, well, the specific question is, you know, at what point or when does the person begin to exist? Anybody get an answer on that or a comment?
Well, yeah, something that crossed my mind, I think, is implied when Jesus was talking to Nicodemus about the new birth. The Christian rebirth comes immediately when we were fertilized with the Holy Spirit. You know, Christian conception happens, the new birth, when we receive Christ, happens immediately. It's not a gestation period, you know, and then we're born into the kingdom. It happens immediately, and I believe that he was showing the parallels to Nicodemus of the birth in relationship to the second birth. So just by implication, or that's the
association.
Yeah, association, that's why I understand it.
That's a good point. Never thought of that before. Okay, so you'd say then at the point of conception, right, when the egg is fertilized, the sperm meets the egg, and that's the point.
It's like the Holy Spirit's, you know, the fertilization in our conception's immediately.
And that does happen just like that, apparently, from embryological studies. It's not a slow process. It's almost instantaneous.
Another thing that he brought in is that if you consider the soul, you know, not only your spirit, but your mind, your emotion, and your will, and your personality, that what determines that is the genetic thing, that the two, parent cells come together, you know, and immediately that's determined in the personality, the mind.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was interesting.
Out of millions of possibilities, two become one. Yeah. Good. Okay.
One other thing. The Bible doesn't say where a person becomes a living soul. And the one point that is definite, that's clear, is conception. Any other point along the 40 weeks is guaranteed to be purely on the basis of man's thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And the one act that we're sure of, that we know occurs, is conception.
Mm-hmm.
The next act
mm-hmm.
we know that occurs is birth.
Mm-hmm.
So just kind of, the only thing I can really point my finger on, I have no basis on the scripture, but I know I can point at it and say this actually occurred is conception.
Mm-hmm.
Any other point I pick is purely my thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me is very dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That probably will become even more significant with the advances that are being made, you know, if we continue on what the line of development that's currently going. There will be a day strange as it may seem, when there may be a total extracorporeal pregnancy. That means a pregnancy that's carried from fertilization to birth, or no birth, but from fertilization to full human development, totally outside the uterus. Now that's, you know, a few years off, but unless something happens to change it, it's almost a predictable event. But still, if that were, even if that were the case, and I'm not saying it should be, but if it were, you'd still have that event of conception, whether it's in a test tube or otherwise. Let's take one more, and then we'll stop. Is there ever a justification for abortion?
Scripturally speaking, see, that was so.
Well,
we had a hard time defining
we're
just when does life.
I would hope that we use the scriptures.
Right.
You know, it would agree in here that we're going to use the scriptures as a basis for determining if we can use the scriptures if it speaks. You know, directly or indirectly.
I think we could deal with some of the common justifications that people come up with. Maybe address each one and.
Yeah. I'll give you a few. One often used in the medical field is, if I don't do it, somebody else will. Is that a justification for abortion?
I wouldn't want to be the one to say that. If I were you as a doctor, I wouldn't want to say, if I don't do it, somebody else will.
How about this one? If I don't do it, she'll go somewhere else or do it herself and end up being harmed or killed or maimed.
But the Lord doesn't want you to partake in anything that has appearances of evil. And also, you know, I know that the Lord doesn't want us to compromise on our standards.
So you'd say, what, in response to that, you'd say, there is never a justification?
There's never a justification for abortion.
Well, at least from what you're saying, I think, you know, God's going to hold you responsible for what you do. And you have to take pains to have a clear conscience toward God, and you wouldn't have one if you didn't think it was a good thing to do, mm-hmm. regardless of the consequences for you.
Not only that, but I'm not a doctor, so the things that I understand you saying can never enter my mind,
mm-hmm.
because I'm not capable of,
mm-hmm.
of the practice.
Mm-hmm. But that's what, I just want to let you know what the thinking is among doctors, and I know it's spoken of in this city that way. In fact, I talked to a fellow I am close friends with who's an obstetrician, and that was the rationale he used. You know, if I don't do it, either some other doctor's going to do it who's already, his excuse was, this other doctor's already so busy doing abortions that, you know, to send my patient to him is going to compromise her health.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd rather do it for her than to take a chance on putting her in his mill. In response to this last point, that if a reputable medical facility doesn't do the abortion, that a woman will go elsewhere and have an illegal abortion. This is a very interesting article that came out this week, June 6th, in the national publication Morbidity and Mortality Report, which interestingly comes from Texas. And the title of it is The Effects of Restricted Federal Funding for Abortion-Texas. And this was a large metropolitan area of Texas near the Mexican border, so it was an area where there were a lot of Medicaid Title 20 funded abortions prior to the, I guess Texas has now repealed the federal funding for abortion. And that whole thing is up for grabs, you know, the Hyde Amendment that went through and now is being questioned. But at least during the time it was being held in repeal, they did a study down somewhere along the border. And to summarize the study, it says, in Texas, pregnant, low-income women who do not have federal or state funds for abortions do not appear to be resorting to illegal abortions to terminate unwanted pregnancies. These findings are consistent with those from a national monitoring system, which also could not document that the restriction of public funds for abortion caused a large percentage of Medicaid-eligible women to choose self-induced or non-physician-induced abortions. And that's a little bit wordy. What they're saying is that just because we don't federally fund abortions doesn't mean that there's going to be a higher mortality among this group of women. And that's been the justification, you see, for using federal funds, and also for a lot of doctors saying, well, we should do it because if we don't, they're going to have illegal abortions. What happened was they just had more babies.
You know, my husband and I had a ministry where we ministered with a lot of, I mean, poor people. And they don't go and have abortions. They have these kids.
Mm-hmm.
It's the other classes of people who can afford the abortions that have the abortions. It's people who are sacrificing that child because they don't feel like it's time right now for them to have kids.
Well, let's take a little bit and just go through some things that may relate to this whole issue or these issues, and then I hope we'll have a little time to talk and discuss toward the end of our session today. The issue of abortion really goes back into ancient times because it's not just been a recent skill that's been developed. The Egyptians were able to induce abortions, and the Greeks knew about it, didn't practice it highly, and probably it was because of their deep appreciation for life that they did not pursue this activity. The Romans began to practice it some in the later years of their society. But the real debt of gratitude that we owe for the concept of life as we have it in our culture today is neither to the Greeks nor the Romans nor to the Egyptians, but it's really to the Bible, to the Judeo-Christian teaching of the Scriptures, because it was in the Scriptures that the concept of life as being sacred, as being made in the image of God, came through. And thus the ethic that was taught in the Bible and that was later extolled by the Church was the view that life is unique, that it's to be protected and to be loved because the individual is created in the image of God. And today, 2,000 years later, the consensus of society in all the West, both in Western Europe and in America, and probably in other parts of the world too, is no longer based on the Judeo-Christian ethic. It's based on rather a humanistic ethic. And I don't know if any of you, or maybe all of you, are very familiar with what humanism is, but I thought we'd take just a few minutes to try to review and clarify what the basic ethic of our Western culture is today. And to put that in relief, I just drew a navigator, or we use it a lot in the navigators, the wheel illustration, to remind us of what the Christian life is. It's a life that's lived with Christ at the center, and the Christian living in obedience to that center of his life, the person of Christ, and connected to that by four basic elements, and that is the Word of God as being the authority in his life, prayer as being his contact with God, fellowship as being the way to maintain encouragement and to make sure that one's not going off the deep end in some area, and just for enjoyment, and then finally witnessing or sharing with other people who do not necessarily know Christ. So that's sort of very basic, but I'd like to show it in relation to what I think is another type of philosophy, that is the philosophy of humanism. And this would be the humanistic wheel. And we could go through this and spend some time, and I've got verses on all these points, but basically you have man in the middle instead of Christ. Man is the center. He feels the center of all things, feels he's autonomous, he is independent, he is his own measure, and would therefore reject any moralistic concept or concept of a divine person or creation, because he sees himself as being the center of all things. And then the Bible in Romans 1 and in Colossians 2 speaks of the emptiness of the philosophy of the world. And Romans 1 in particular mentions the rebelliousness of man, and I see that as a rebellious humanist living the empty or deceitful life, just empty of any meaning whatsoever. In fact, Colossians uses the word empty deceit together to describe this sort of attitude. The things that connect man with his life then would be the writings of men down through the ages, basically philosophers and other thinkers. Colossians 2 also talks about how that he is puffed up with visions of his own importance and an attempt to relate himself to the rest of the universe. And in today's jargon, that's sort of a cosmic awareness. And this is very prevalent in a lot of the humanistic writing, that we need to become aware of who we are in our universe. Then instead of fellowship as Christians, the humanist basically is left with just a very hedonistic existence of eating, drinking, and being merry, doing all he can to find pleasure. And rather than propagating Christ, proclaiming Christ, he is propagating his own deceit. His outreach to the world is basically that of error, because it's based on false concepts. So the result of that life then is not only emptiness and deceit, but it's also despair and death. And I would refer you to the writings of Francis Schaeffer for a good bit more discussion on the despair that comes with that sort of living. So today, the view that man is simply a product of chance in an impersonal universe dominates both sides of the Iron Curtain, because Russian and Chinese thinking is that of humanism, and that's prevalent on our side of the Iron Curtain as well. And even the liberal elements of the church are being swept aside by the tide of this thinking. And they're very confused because they don't use the scripture in its entirety to base their doctrines on, and they use instead the doctrines of man. So what we're seeing then is the natural result of humanism in its secular and theological forms. The result of that then is that the human race is being degraded. It's being devalued. And man is seen as simply a machine, simply a functional unit whose button is to be pushed for a certain activity or for a certain response, with no value of him as an individual. One result of that is that if this is taken through, people have a very low opinion of themselves. If they simply see themselves as being a functional unit, it provides no opportunity for uniqueness, for self-worth and self-esteem. And also it decreases our evaluation of the worth of others. We tend to view other people as also simply functional, simply to be sort of pushed or pushed aside for a certain activity. If man is only a machine, then he can also be manipulated, not only as he lives, but before he lives, by genetic manipulation, by screening who becomes able to have children, by screening which children are accepted into the world and which ones are evaluated and decided that their life is not worth living and they're discarded. And you might be interested to know that the very scientists who discovered the DNA sequence, his name's escaped me for the moment, Watson and Crick. Right. One of those gentlemen, I believe it's Crick, has postulated the concept of evaluating a baby at 2 days of age and deciding if he or she is worthy of living, or if there's any major defect, then that baby would be discarded after life has actually already entered the world. So we have a very clear-cut, you know, issue of infanticide at that point. But anyway, the idea would be then that it'd be okay to tinker with man, to try to build a better machine, a more functional unit, a more efficient one. And the importance of the richness of life is not even considered, but simply function. Thus, who's going to say what a better machine should look like, or act like, or relate? Well, it would be probably the arbitrary values of a biological or genetic engineer. And this field is already emerging, the field of biological and genetic engineering. is already surfacing. In Time magazine, August 1, 1977, it said of sociobiology, quote, "Few academic theories have spread so fast with so little hard proof," end quote. Well, why is this? How can this be happening? We have already been programmed by our society to accept the doctrine of scientific infallibility. That is, if science says it, it's got to be true. That's the name of the game in our age. So we tend to acquiesce to whatever the authorities in science tell us without really looking at the hard proof. And because science is not scrutinized as closely as we'd like to think it is, there could be monstrous leaps in many areas with very little proof or reliability or the effect of a certain concept. And I think that's what we are seeing in this whole area of sociobiology and genetic engineering, is because it is very subjective at this point, and really a lot of facts are not known about the long-term results. Things are happening so fast, the technological procedures are emerging so quickly that nobody is taking time and seemingly has, nor has the time, to really decide if we should proceed in this area. You know, on the issue of test tube babies, this whole thing is really coming on, because now we've seen at least two opportunities where doctors have taken a ovum that's been fertilized outside the womb and placed it in a mother who desired that child, and the babies have been brought to term, delivered, and are normal, happy, growing children. And I personally don't have a problem with that. I think that's one more way that medical science, you know, can help parents who are otherwise unable to have children, because the mother mothered the child, the father fathered the child. It was simply that they had a little help at one point. But the implications are very strong for what could happen, you know, if this skill, this technique, is then carried on to more mass-produced and less closely supervised situations. So the result of humanism, which is supposed to exalt man, is really the devaluation of man and the human race. Of all the subjects that relate to this devaluation and the erosion of the sanctity of life, Francis Schaeffer says abortion is the keystone. And he would draw a little illustration that would show abortion as a domino and infanticide as a domino standing right next to it, and euthanasia as a domino standing right next to that. And he would say the abortion domino has already fallen. The infanticide domino is falling, and euthanasia, that is mercy killing of older people, is the next one to go. And I think we'll see why he's saying that as we talk this morning. But he feels that abortion is the keystone. And if we can make our thoughts and our influence count there, then perhaps we can stop this effect that's progressing. Professor John Noonan, Jr., who's professor of law at Berkeley, said, and I quote, "Human life has less protection in the United States today than at any time since the inception of our country," end of quote. And the reason he says that is because of the Supreme Court decision of this past decade. Because what's happened is that in 1973, our United States Supreme Court, by an arbitrary, absolute ruling, swept into legality abortion on demand. And this past year, 1979, saw over a million babies, unborn babies, being killed as a result of that action. Now, one thing I'd like to take just a few minutes to talk about, and that is, what does the Bible say about abortion? And we have talked, and I agree with you, that it doesn't say anything specifically other than perhaps the passage in Exodus 21. But that's really not a therapeutic or intended or induced abortion. It was more of an accident. And unfortunately, Dr. Bruce Waelke, whom some of you may know from Dallas Seminary or know of, took that passage and back in 1968 tried to develop some conclusions from that passage, and from those conclusions inferred that human life in utero was not to be equated with human life extra euro, because in that little tax there was not life for life expected. In other words, when the abortion was produced, the man who injured the woman was not expected to give his life. He was simply to pay a penalty. And so he had construed from that intrauterine life was not of the same value, or if it had been, there would have been life for life required. As a result of that, he wrote a chapter in this book, which came out in 1968, called Birth Control and the Christian, put out by the Christian Medical Society. Came out about 5 years before the Supreme Court legalized abortion. And, you know, some of the statements in here really are very relative. And it was on the basis of this book, basically, that early in my medical career felt justified in doing abortions, and did on a number of occasions. Don't shoot me down. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. But the impact of that one interpretation, this is to show how important the scriptures are and how you interpret them. The impact of that one interpretation probably allowed for many, many abortions to be done by well-intended physicians for many years before he rethought the thing, and before I did and others who were trying to sort out what the scriptures said. So it really is important how you interpret, particularly when the scriptures don't speak clearly to an issue. I think that the scriptures do point out that there is value to human life. There's no question from the cover to cover. That's why Christ came, and that's why he paid the penalty for our sins, was so that we might have value and might have a meaningful and purposeful life. There are three ways you can look at the scripture if you're talking to an individual who says, well, what does the Bible say about abortion? One is that the Bible simply regards it as an amoral act. That is, it doesn't say anything about it because it doesn't matter. It's amoral. Secondly, that the Bible views it as a relative moral situation. That is, it is permissible at times, whereas at other times it's not permissible. And that's basically the attitude this book takes. Birth Control and the Christian would say that it's a relative situation. Even including family distress would be an indication for abortion. And you can take that one to almost any length you want to take it, depending on how distressed a person has to be before they're candidate for abortion. The final possibility is the fact that if the fetus is a human being, then he has to be regarded, or she has to be regarded, with the same value as any other human being, regardless of its gestational age or whether it's actually been born into the world or not. And therefore would be protected by the sixth commandment, thou shalt not kill. And I strongly believe, as a result of studying the scriptures, of reading the writings of Dr. Bruce Waelke, who has subsequently done a great deal more study and thought, and who back in 1975, as a result of his thinking and research, basically retracted his earlier opinion, and in an article in the Journal of Evangelical Theological Society, restates his position to show that because the fetus is a human being and because human life has worth, that abortion is not permitted in the scriptures. He would give one qualifying conclusion on that, and I think I would agree, although I would be very respectful of any individual's viewpoint on this, particularly as they view the sovereignty of God, and that would be that if the fetus is aggressively harming his or her mother, then that would be an indication for abortion, even for a believing, Bible-believing Christian. And I realize that if you take the sovereignty of God to its ultimate natural conclusion, that you could believe, and I would respect you if you did so, that, you know, God can save me from this otherwise seemingly, you know, deadly situation. And there are very, very few situations in which that's ever the case. I have never seen it. Now, you mentioned, you know, Dr. Miller in Denton. Was that the one who had had that occur, where the mother's life was threatened and died?
That was, you know, a child was just, I don't know what the details were.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know some situations in which it could occur. I know of a couple of situations where it looked like it might occur, but I've never had a situation or even heard a specialist in the field bring up a situation where it actually did occur, or whether, or where that was really the question, whether it was really an issue.
In the series of films that Coop and Schaefer put out, you may have seen those.
I haven't, but I'm going to, real soon.
Coop, at the time when I saw it in San Antonio, he personally was there and spoke, and he about an hour talk.
Mm-hmm.
And he said in his practice of pediatric surgery since 1947, he has never had a case where that.
Right, I heard him say that on tape. That's quite a...
He's heard of a few where it's possible. He said in mm-hmm. that many years, he's personally never had a
mm-hmm.
situation.
And I believe he supports the point of view that he would recommend or advise or at least accept abortion under those circumstances.
Yeah, he seemed to indicate that he would, but he said that he says usually what the situation is of it being a difficult pregnancy for
right.
the mother. And simply making it easier for her, and then taking the earliest possible point when that child could live outside the womb.
Right.
That time period is just becoming smaller and smaller and smaller.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Any other questions or comments about the scriptural position? I would recommend this article to you.
Would you give us?
Yes. It's the topic is Reflections from the Old Testament on Abortion. It's in the 1975, I don't know the month, December, I believe, Journal of the Evangelical Theological Society.
1971?
75.
And you've got December issue?
Evangelical Theological Society.
Is there a Dallas Seminary?
No. He was professor at Dallas Seminary at that time. And Dr. Bruce K. Waltke, Waltke. I have one extra copy. If somebody's really interested, you can have it or go get it Xeroxed.
How did you spell it last
time? Waltke. Thus, if what we're saying is true, then we can say that abortion is really equivalent to murder. And therefore, if a million children are being aborted each year in our country, then there are being a million murders carried out legally in our country each year. One more way you can see that there is devaluation in the value of life. Now, interesting, we mentioned a little bit while ago, I think somebody did, about the fact that there's no other point in gestation where you can definitely say that an event is happening. But conception, you can say that about. If the Supreme Court had considered that in their decision of 1973, they would have been, I think, a much wiser group of jurists. But their thinking at that time, and the thinking of the doctors that probably influenced them, was that there is a so-called age of viability, and that would be the age at which a fetus could live outside the mother's womb. And so the legal document at first said that abortions will not be done after the age of viability. The problem has been that since 1973, that age of viability has been decreasing, and interestingly, abortions have been done later and later and later. So the two are actually overlapping now. And what we're seeing is the result of this misguided thinking. And whereas they had initially proved only first trimester, first 13 weeks abortions, now we're seeing abortions done in the second and sometimes even third trimester legally with the sanctions of the Supreme Court. And yet pediatricians are now able to save about 40% of 1 kilogram babies. That's only 2.2 pound babies. 40% of those can now be saved. And there's at least one premature baby who weighed 600 grams. That's only about a pound, who is now still, as far as I know, being kept alive and perhaps will be a functional human being. If you think about that, that's really overwhelming. So that what has been produced has been a number of situations that have been very distressing, where there have been live abortions around the country, babies that have been born as a result of abortions who have been functional, viable infants, and the doctors and nurses didn't know what to do. And there have been lawsuits, one for at least $17 million, and much public outcry and protest over this situation. So all this is a result of an arbitrary decision on the part of our Supreme Court. Now, what are the implications of abortion? What does it mean? Well, it probably means more than I know, and perhaps more than you or anybody else does, but there are several ideas I'd like to toss out to you. First of all, as we've mentioned, it means the devaluation of all human life. It means that our life in this room, sitting here today, has been made less valuable, at least to our society, not to God, but to our society and in our country, by the fact that it's so easy and so nonchalant to simply terminate the lives of a million people in our country each year. Another implication is that regards child abuse. Now, this is very interesting, because you would think that if a million babies were being prevented from coming into the world, that they would be unwanted babies, and therefore the ones that do come into the world would be accepted, desired, and cared for, and that therefore you'd see a drastic drop in the child abuse rate. Well, just the opposite has happened. And in 1972, there were 60,000 abuse cases reported. That was the year before the Supreme Court legalized abortion. In 1976, there were over 500,000 child abuse cases reported. That's an eightfold increase in 4 years. Now, your first thought would be, well, child abuse is heavily unreported. That's true. They estimate that for every one that is reported, at least one or two are not. But that rate of reporting probably didn't change that much. In other words, there are probably just as many unreported children in 1972 as there were in 1976, because the issue was very much an issue in 72, as well as 76, as well as the present time. Why this increase? Why the eightfold increase, despite the fact the population was about, the number of babies were the same, or maybe a little bit less, and the fact that the babies that were being born were apparently, or should have been, wanted?
Excuse me, eightfold increase between
1972 and 76, yeah, nationally. Well, the scenario goes something like this, and it often is subconscious. I don't think a person would necessarily think this out loud, but the idea would be, if it's okay to kill an unborn baby, then what's wrong with taking a baby who is born and throwing him around a little bit? Or another way to say it is, why charge a crime after birth when there's no crime charged before birth? So whether that's really conscious thinking or not, I think that type of attitude has been one evidence of the fact that life has been devalued as a result of abortion. Another implication of abortion is that there are fewer babies to adopt. That's just simply a sad implication, because there are a lot of parents that would love to have a child and they can't themselves, and they'd like to adopt, and there just aren't that many children for adoption. A very ironic implication is the fact that we're now seeing children who are babies who are born who are not wanted and who were maybe missed abortions. They're simply being folded in a towel and left to suffocate, or sometimes even strangled or deliberately killed, or injections of lethal solutions being placed into their bodies. Whereas in the same hospital, because a baby of less weight, of less potential viability, is being taken and very carefully nurtured, transported on helicopters to regional pediatric intensive care units, and every effort and hundreds of thousands of dollars spent to try to save this less viable infant simply because that child is wanted. And that's great. You know, I'm all for that. But at the same time, it's a tragedy to see a viable infant left simply because a certain person didn't want that infant. Well, as a offshoot of that implication, Francis Coop, or Everett Koop, who wrote the book with Schaefer, makes the point, and I think it's probably true. I haven't seen it directly in my practice or contact in the hospital, but I'm not really involved in that area as much. He states that the implication is that hospital personnel, people who deal daily with not just abortions, not just pediatrics, but with people of a healthy, good outlook, as well as people of older ages who don't have as good an outlook, their concept of their responsibility has been jeopardized, or it has been affected. That is, it's a very subtle and probably subconscious thing. But if certain people aren't important in the hospital, then maybe everybody's not important. And maybe it's not really as important to try as hard to save this old person who's going to die anyway, because it wasn't important to save that little baby who wouldn't have died. So the thinking is, you know, it just begins to creep into all levels of relation. He also, Coop points out that less effort's being made to help congenitally deformed babies because the precedent has been set. Some people just aren't worth saving. And so doctors are not working as hard to rehabilitate infants and young people, even people who are older, near adolescent years, or perhaps in the case of pediatric congenital heart defects. I know of one case in particular, I think it's in Pennsylvania, where the courts have ordered the doctors not to repair a mongoloid child's heart defect because the outlook for that child is not all that good if they did repair his heart defect. And I'm sure all of you...
They've ordered him not to?
Yes, the courts have ordered that not to be done. Parents apparently are somewhat detached and have maybe no real say in the matter, I'm not sure, because the mentally retarded, it's an implication for you and me, because I bet there's illnesses and diseases in this very room that some in society would say, you know, should not be reproduced. Mm-hmm. And that's tragic. So abortion, then, has in only 6 years already come to the point where we've reached infanticide. Mm-hmm. Because when these babies are being folded in towels and left to suffocate, that's infanticide. Question?
Are you familiar with a film? I don't remember the name of it, but I saw it in a class that I took at Oklahoma State University, Death and Dying class. The film was about a mongoloid child that was born, but along with apparently mongolism birth, sometimes the connection of the stomach to
short bowel syndrome.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and a very simple operation could cure that.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a film, a documented film, in fact, commissioned by the parents. And we watched the whole sequence of events, and the parents would not give permission for this operation to be done. And they couldn't feed the child because that would kill him. So they allowed the child to starve to death in a matter of days.
Mm-hmm.
And are you familiar with that?
Yeah, I haven't seen it, but it's out of Johns Hopkins, I believe.
I guess so. But we watched that child die.
Yeah.
And it was incredible.
How did you feel?
Well, it was just horrible. And the nurses expressed, it was terrible because they would hold the child and they couldn't understand why such a healthy baby who could live was not allowed to live when they were making over such infants that didn't have a chance. Mm-hmm. Just the point you were making. The nurses expressed this when we talked about it. It was hideous.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I think everyone in the class believed it was hideous.
But see, every time they see that, every time they go through that sort of situation, it makes them a little bit more calloused to that situation the next time, or to a normal situation.
What do you mean?
It just makes them more calloused in their thinking, you know, toward the normal child, and wondering, well, maybe this child doesn't have everything he should have going for him. Maybe I really shouldn't give all my attention to save this child. Where do you draw the line? Uh-huh. It's a relative value system.
It's the same thing that happened. You know, like we were talking about in Abraham, you know, he knew the right thing, but his children were raised with seeing sin every day, and they didn't know any different, and they grew callous to it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, Lot. You know how Lot was just, he knew the difference, but his children were raised where it's an everyday thing.
Mm-hmm.
It made no big difference.
Mm-hmm.
I know you talk about this becoming callous. One of the things Coop said in this deal was that, you know, when he began his practice and
47 and 50s and that type of thing. He said an abortionist was the worst name you could ever call a doctor. Mm-hmm. And he said, yet today, as he goes and talks to medical students in hospitals for his lectures, he says most of them are not even aware that there's any controversy over abortion. Mm-hmm. If there's ever any reason why you should refuse it. Mm-hmm. It's just it's simply not being expressed to them. Mm-hmm. They're just not aware.
Okay, if we have a few minutes at the end, I'd like for us to discuss. I'd like to try to finish on up and see how this whole issue relates to us in our lives today. In this domino effect, you know, with euthanasia being the next thing to go, I think we can see that abortion is not simply a Roman Catholic issue, as it's been called before. It's not just a religious issue. That abortion is a human issue. It affects every person, whether they have any religious conviction or not. And that's one reason I believe that it's important for us as Christians, not only for our own peace of mind and our own sense of what's right and wrong, to come to conclusions, to come to convictions about this. But I think it's an area where we can relate to the world. I think it's an area where we can show that the Bible, though it doesn't speak directly, doesn't answer the question directly, it does give guidelines and an appreciation for the value of life that will help people who don't have a foothold, don't have anything to plant their feet on, to see that there is a guideline of truth. There is a place where truth is proclaimed, as the Bible claims, thy word is truth. And that can help them find meaning and purpose and reality in their lives. And I've seen that happen here in this city with actually a colleague who went to medical school with in Dallas. He's practicing obstetrics and gynecology here in the city. We've done some Bible studies in one of the hospitals in town here for about the last year or two. And he has come off and on to those studies. Most recently, the topic has been abortion. We've been discussing this. In fact, wound up this morning about a 6 weeks discussion listening to Dr. Koops and Dr. Schaefer's and Dr. Jefferson's tapes from that seminar, and we've now got the film coming. We'll be showing it starting June 16th for about 6 weeks running in the Penrose Hospital to the medical staff and their wives and anybody, you know, who'd like to come to see that. And we'll have discussions afterwards. Well, this friend of mine has been coming and really, you know, probably feels very defensive about the fact that he's doing abortions. But he is very responsive to the Word, to the Scriptures, because he's been going through a Bible series at his church in which they've used the Scriptures as authority. And so he sees that the Bible, you know, speaks in other areas of life. And his question is, well, how does it speak in this area? Well, through the studies, through the contact with other doctors who've thought this thing through articles like Walkie's article that I mentioned to you, where he does a very good job of showing what the Bible doesn't say, but how the Bible's view of life, you know, brings out the validity of life and how we should protect it. This doctor is coming to a point where I think he will not much longer be an abortionist in our city. So that, I think, is one way that we can influence our world. If you look at just, you know, what a disciple does, I think there's some ways we can see that how we live our life and how we view this particular issue, you know, can be a factor to help other people. These are just some scriptural principles that give us an idea of what a disciple is and what he does. In other words, what is inside him and what are the visible evidences of Christ in his life. And the first thing we know is that from several scriptures that for a disciple, Christ is the authority in his life. And that when it comes to decision-making processes, when it comes to identification with the divine, that he is open about that. He openly identifies with Christ. So when people in the world see a person like that, hopefully a person in this room, they're going to take note. They're going to say, I really want to find out more about that person. See what really makes him tick. What is he thinking? Why does he think that? when they begin to scratch the surface, they'll find this disciple abides in the Word. That is, he is taking the Word into his life, he's thinking it over, and he's living it out. He is involved in Bible study, or memory. He's involved in meditating on the Word, and he's involved in applying the Word to his life. And when they see that, they'll begin to take note of the Word itself to see what it says, see how it relates to their life, what it has to say about family issues, what it has to say about interpersonal issues, and then finally what it has to say about their own relationship to God. That may take time. It may take years for that to happen. Bill Voisin was telling me this morning that his parents accepted Christ after 15 years of prayer. You know, and I know of Andrew, was it Andrew Murray that prayed for 50 years for a couple of friends? You know, it may take much time. It may not take that much, but it will take time. A person who sees this disciple living the Christian life will see that he has love. He's demonstrating his love to the community that he lives in. And it's not just a selfish taking love, it's a giving love. And it's a love that looks for opportunities to serve. It's a love that finds expression in his family. And that individual will be attracted to this person. He'll want to find out more about that. As he gets to know him, he'll find out that he is open to teaching. He is not just a closed individual, but he is a learner. He's open and teachable. And by definition, that's what disciple means. And yet, ultimately, he learns from his master. He learns from Christ. Though he is open to various teachings, his final authority is Christ. And so as this person views this disciple, he'll realize that here's a guy who has a final arbiter in his life, a final decision maker, and that decision maker is the Bible and the person of Christ, the Holy Spirit. And then hopefully, as he gets to know that individual, that disciple, he'll see that that disciple's life is a fruitful life. It's not just a stale, staid life, but one in which he can relate to the community he lives in. He can relate to various issues, like the issue of abortion, or the issue of women's lib, or the issue of civil disobedience, or the issue of demonism or Satan worship, or whatever current contemporary issue is on the scene. This disciple can relate to that, and he can help the other person, the person who's onlooking, begin to develop a fruitful life also, a life in which Christ will be the center of his life, that he'll begin to abide in the Word, he'll begin to have love because Christ is living in him, he'll begin to be open and teachable, and his life too will bear fruit. So it's the ongoing process of discipleship. But these contemporary issues, I see them bearing relation to that, in that we need to be able to talk from those issues to get people's attention in those areas to then bring them to focus on the real issues of Christ and who he is. And I've seen that happen a number of times just in places like hospital dining rooms. Recently, we were talking through, I guess, for 4 or 5 doctors there, and the issue of homosexuality, no, it was incest, came up. And I just tossed out the idea that, you know, whereas homosexuality is being the current discussion point, and probably 15 years from now, or maybe less, 10, 8 years from now, probably incest will be that same focus of discussion. And they said, well, why do you say that? Somebody asked that question. I said, well, because the Bible says that there's a gradual deterioration in societies that let themselves be taken away from an allegiance to God. And that's what happened in the Old Testament. It's what happened in the time of Rome and Corinth. And I think it's no reason that it won't happen to us today. Now that, you know, they may have forgotten that, but if that day comes when incest is accepted like homosexuality, they may remember that. They may think, well, you know, maybe the Bible does have something to say about that. Hopefully they'll think about it sooner. But that's the way I see that these issues relate to discipleship. Have a few minutes here. We could open for questions. We're out on the button at 12:30, but we could take a minute or two if you have some burning topics.
I have one. The issue of sterilization as a method of birth control.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where can you say something to short on that? You know,
Yeah, I appreciate you mentioning that. Though we didn't really talk about birth control, I think there's a pretty clear-cut implication from the fact that we talk about conception as being the beginning of life. And as I see it, birth control that interferes with conception, you know, something that happens before conception, is not violating human life. Because if life begins at the time that the egg is fertilized, anything that happens after that deals with human life. And something that happens before that really doesn't deal with a human life. It deals with the potential for human life. But then there are millions of those. I mean, there are literally billions of sperm, and there are millions of eggs in proportionate numbers. And not all those are going to reach life, and I don't think God intended that they should. But once there's a fertilization, and that's a different matter. So as I understand, as I see it, as I practice it with my patients, any birth control method that simply blocks the joining of sperm and egg is acceptable. One that destroys the fertilized or implanted egg would not be morally acceptable. And just by way of specifics, you know, the IUD is a birth control device that apparently does several things, but it basically interferes after fertilization, increases the transit time of the egg down the tube, so that if the egg is fertilized in the usual place, then it's not quite ready for implantation in the uterus. Secondly, it irritates the lining of the uterus sufficiently to make it unlikely that implantation, and therefore viable pregnancy would develop. And, you know, so I basically see it as causing many abortions, many MINI abortions.
What about the morning after pill? Is that, now I have just heard, I don't know if it's, uh-huh. if it's something that is being used or what. Now, what is that?
Well, it's a high dose of estrogen. It's rather controversial even among, you know, doctors. But I think it would work the same way. It would interfere after conception has taken place. The birth control pill, though, apparently doesn't, in my understanding, work that way. And Morgan, perhaps you know more information recently than I do.
My understanding of birth control pills now actually prevent the egg from being released.
Mm-hmm.
But if the egg is released, there is conception. I don't think. Well, it might affect the lining of the uterus enough to prevent it. But mm-hmm. its main purpose is to prevent the release.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as best that I can determine from the information that we have medically, the pill would be an acceptable form because it doesn't interfere with the conception itself or after conception. It simply basically prevents ovulation, keeps the egg from being released. And certainly any mechanical method, you know, anything that stands between the sperm and the egg would be an acceptable method. Now, I hope that's not being dogmatic. I don't want to be like, you know, other people who have studied this matter come up with very dogmatic points, but you've got to be practical at some point.
Do contraceptives have any danger to the health of the woman who takes them? I
mean, you mean like birth control pills?
Yeah.
They do.
Some do.
They do. Well, I think all of them have some, you know, complicating feature. The lower the dose, which we're gradually, you know, seeing happen, the actual milligram amount is lower and lower. The lower that dose, the less likely there is to have things like clots and heart disease and high blood pressure and so forth. So it's much safer now than it was, say, 10 years ago.
I've heard there's been also some emotional type problems along mm-hmm. with different hormones.
Right. Right.
Well, I guess one of the questions that Christians have in their own Christian society is whether a person should somehow trust God,
mm-hmm.
know if it was facing the kids, and how many versus where they should use the birth control method to space their kids as they could have.
Mm-hmm.
That's a whole different issue.
It is. Right. I have no problem with a person that wants to do that, you know, views God's sovereignty as absolute. You know, somewhere in there, though, man's responsibility does come in. We know we're responsible in, you know, ways that relate to salvation, and we're responsible for how we use our time and our money and So somewhere in there we're responsible for how we use our bodies too. That's all I have, and I think it's time for dinner. So thank you for your thoughts and your questions and your attention.